It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, politicians are just a click away on social media. But does that really mean they're more accessible to voters? We'll talk to the author of the new book, Selfie Democracy, about politics in a digital world. Now, art and music education has been part of schools for decades, and there's been new movement toward STEAM education, adding art into science, technology, engineering, and math. There's a good chance you took art classes throughout elementary and middle school, maybe beyond. But our next guest says we can take things further and breathe new life into schools if we use the arts to rethink and ultimately save our education system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you value having art and music classes in schools? What did it do for you, you think, as a person? And did your non-art classes encourage creativity in some way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Erica Halverson is professor of curriculum and instruction at UW-Madison's School of Education and the mayor of Whoopin' Soccer, a youth arts program based in Madison. Erica is the author of How the Arts Can Save Education, Transforming Teaching, Learning, and Instruction. She recently started a podcast. It's called Arts Educators Save the World. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with an important distinction here. I think when I think of art classes, I think elementary school, we took a break, walked over to art class, did art. Or high school, I took as many band classes as I could. You're talking about something different, though. Kind of having an artistic mindset, I think, behind education. Can you talk about that?
Sure. First of all, I want to say that I also think about the concept of the arts more inclusively, to consider any kinds of disciplines where people produce things. So the performing arts, the visual arts, the media arts, all are encompassed under this umbrella of arts and arts education and art making. And then also to talk a little to your point about art making, not just as a distinct and separate task from the quote unquote real work of school, but of artistic ways of knowing and doing and being as central to what it means to teach and to learn and to become human across all the spaces where we think about education and schooling.
Can you paint us a picture of what that might look like in the classroom?
Sure. So one of the core things that we learn when we make art is how to create representations. That is, how to take an idea, a concept, a story, and retranslate it using the medium of a particular art form. So a painting is a representation. A theatrical performance is a representation. A TikTok video is a representation. The same core mechanism that we value in art making is exactly what we hope our learners across all of our disciplines can learn to do in school. So a math equation is also a representation. It uses the tools of mathematics to communicate a complicated idea that is difficult to share using other mechanisms of communication. So my vision for reinvigorating life and creativity into schools is to recognize how the arts give young people access to the kinds of practices that we really care about that they do in all of their schooling lives across the full school day. So it might look like a project that stretches across the visual arts classroom and the mathematics classroom. It might look like using some of the tools of teaching in improvisation and applying those to the science classroom. It might be something as simple as giving kids the opportunity to take risks in their classroom space that they might not otherwise take without working together around an artistic process in order to get free them up to do the disciplinary academic work in the other parts of their school day.
You just mentioned risk-taking, and I wanted to talk about that a little, because, you know, at various points in my schooling and professional life, the main thing I wanted to do was not be wrong.
Yeah.
And that isn't always the most conducive to learning stuff. Can you talk about the value of risk-taking and the opportunity to be wrong?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges we face in the current failure-focused environment of schooling is how do we communicate both to kids, but also to educators, that failure is a part of learning and not a lack of learning. How do we encourage learning environments, that is classrooms, after school spaces, sports teams, interactions between tutors and students? How do we encourage them to think about trying new things, trying ways of knowing, putting out there ideas that you may or may not believe to be ultimately the best answer as part of what it means to do learning? And learning to take risks is the most effective mechanism for that. And for better or worse, as you probably know, and as all listeners know, you can't simply say to people, okay, now it's time to take risks, and magically people open up toward risk-taking. You have to, what we call in education speak, scaffold their capacity for risk-taking. And I love the scaffolding metaphor because it invokes images of a building held up at first by an external set of tools that then slowly are taken away as the infrastructure for the building is built and can then stand on its own. And so in my book, and in my work with arts educators, I talk a lot about what are the kinds of scaffolds that arts practices allow us to build so that we can eventually take them away and embed risk-taking into the everyday practices of teaching and learning.
Talking to Erica Halverson from the UW-Madison School of Education. New podcast called Arts Educators Save the World. You could join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about arts and creativity, how to get them into the classroom, not just the art classroom or music classroom, but all day long. If you're a teacher, what do you think of the ideas you're hearing? Are you able to do this? Have you found ways to do this in your own classes? As a student, past or present, were there teachers, were there classes that really stimulated your creativity? And did it help you learn more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Erica, this new podcast, Art Educators Save the World, just out last week. Want to listen to a bit of it? Lin-Manuel Miranda on here and Robert Lopez and their teacher, Barbara Ames, in a conversation. Here's Lin-Manuel Miranda talking about a life-changing teacher.
It was life-changing for me. I think the direct education we got from Barbara wanting us to like go headlong into running our own show and the empowerment that comes with student-run theater, because I saw from seventh grade onward what could be done. And then I directed West Side Story my senior year for musical rep. And I grabbed the stuff from the movie I wanted to. I did the Boy Girl America. I swapped Krupke and Cool. I went to the Barbara Ames School of Make the Best Show Possible for Your Students.
Also, I believe your teacher, Barbara Ames, was the let's put on a show model of teaching. Could you talk a little bit about what you got out of that conversation?
Oh, so many things. I mean, not to sell my own radio, but I would encourage everyone to subscribe and listen to these amazing conversations. The idea behind the podcast in general is successful artists talking with their mentors about the impact that arts education has had on their lives. And we started with Lin-Manuel Miranda and Bobby Lopez because they had the same transformational elementary school music teacher as did I. And we, all of us, attribute the kinds of experiences that Barbara Ames gave us directly to the kinds of human beings we became. And part of that was Barbara's commitment to engaging all of us in the process of making theater and making music. Part of it was the ways in which she encouraged us to take risks in our own artistic lives as pretty young children. You know, she was our teacher when we were in kindergarten through sixth grade. And you hear it a little bit from Lynn, and the same is true for myself. And, you know, if listeners don't know Robert Lopez's name just from hearing it, he is the co-writer of Frozen, the movie soundtrack and musical, along with several other Broadway musicals. So these are incredibly accomplished composers, songwriters, some of the greatest of the 21st century. And Barbara is the one who gave us access to our creative selves as young children and encouraged us to carry that forward through creative projects in our schooling lives beyond our time with her, as Lynn said, into high school, both of them obviously into college. And for myself, as an artist turned academic, thinking about the relationship between the stories that she helped me figure out how to tell and improving other people's lives through education, it is an unmatched set of experiences that we got through our education with Barbara.
We're talking to Erica Halverson, professor at UW-Madison School of Education, author of the book, How the Arts Can Save Education. Her new podcast, we were just talking about it, is called Arts Educators Save the World. She joined us to talk about her research on the value of art in schools and not just in separate art classes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you find in your schooling, say, a teacher, a class, a style of teaching that helped boost your creativity? And did that help you grasp difficult topics along the way? If you're a teacher yourself, do you find ways to encourage creativity in your students? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Erica Halverson, UW-Madison education professor, author of the book, How the Arts Can Save Education, with us today to talk about a research on the importance of using art in the classroom, not just in the art classroom. You could join in at 800-642-1234 to share your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest about how to put some of these ideas into practice. Again, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. Michael is with us in Spring Green. Michael, hi.
Hi. I was just mentioning the fact that I'm a professor emeritus, taught at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for many decades in the art department. And I had students, young adults from all kinds of different fields that were in my classes, different majors, everything from computer science to medicine. And I always expected that out of the group, maybe one would become an artist. But what I think the arts really contributes to a bigger picture is the idea that the critique and criticism is a very valuable skill. And it encourages critical thinking, which can apply to just about any profession. And I think art people that have art backgrounds see things differently than just any other person does. And it's because of that ability to see things in different ways that they can apply those skills to just about any profession.
Michael, thanks for the call. Erica, what do you think?
Yeah, that Michael was not a plant, although I think very well could have been. Critique practice is a great technique for engaging teachers who maybe aren't arts teachers in some of the ways of knowing and doing that we really value in the arts. In my own classes at the university, I teach folks who are planning to become teachers. And I also teach folks who are artists who want to become teaching artists, that is, teach in their lives, but maybe not become certified classroom teachers. And one of my favorite days is a day I call Getting Beyond Good Job, which is where we learn how to talk to one another about the work that we make to develop some of those critique skills that Michael was talking about. So learning to notice, that is, engaging with a piece of artwork, whether that's a piece of visual art or performance art, and learning to notice things in the work is an excellent mechanism for developing a teaching and learning technique that can be utilized across different disciplines, because it allows us to engage with one another's work without without evaluation, first of all, and by giving the kind of productive feedback that allows people to improve on their representations, on the ways in which they're communicating ideas to each other.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Erica, for somebody wanting to put that idea into practice, I think we hear words like critique and criticism and think, here's how the thing you did was bad. And that's clearly not what you're talking about. For somebody, maybe a teacher out there listening who wants to do this in the classroom tomorrow, what could that look like?
Yes. So there, I mentioned learning to notice. I have a very simple set of questions that I use to teach about critique that I've adapted from Harvard Project Zero, which is a very well-known kind of arts education research house around the country. And they have a lot of free resources on their website. But my kind of simplified version of critique is having people present work to one another and asking everyone to respond to the questions, what do you notice? What does this remind you of? And what do you still want to know? And the reason I like those questions is that they surface the parts of someone's work that stand out to others without any evaluative language associated with it, right? So for example, someone might notice the vibrant colors in a painting. That doesn't mean you like the vibrant colors, you don't like the vibrant colors, but you notice those colors. And that is an opportunity for feedback and conversation, where the artist can say, yeah, I was really thinking the vibrant colors could do A, B, or C. Or, you know, I hadn't really intended for vibrant colors. I see that everyone is noticing that. Here are the kinds of changes I'm going to make to this work in order to make the colors less vibrant so that that is not the first thing that people notice when they examine my work.
Talking to Erica Halverson, professor at UW-Madison School of Education. Erica has a new podcast called Arts Educators Save the World, talking about creativity in our schools. Erica, something that always strikes me, you know, when I think back to my math education, a lot of it was a chore, drudgery in a lot of ways. And then when I interview mathematicians, they're talking about how much creativity goes into problem solving and how much they play with numbers. I mean, they're doing hard stuff too. How do we get that spirit from the pros and bring it into the stuff that to K through 12 kids are getting?
Oh, that is such a great question. You know, I have also heard that from mathematicians. And you hear all the time about the connections between making math and making music, making math and making art. There's some really exciting research around how very old arts practices like weaving are highly mathematized. And there's incredible research going on that starts with the mathematized arts practices and uses those practices as a mechanism to move toward some of the more standard representational tools that we use in math classes. So I would say step one begins with identifying the arts practices that are themselves mathematical. And rather than requiring we start with the standardized math practices and require students pass through those before, quote unquote, getting to the good stuff, what if we started with the good stuff and used those opportunities as a way in to the standardized mathematics practices?
We just have a couple minutes left, and I don't want to get out of this without talking about whooping soccer.
Sure.
I was going to try to describe it to people, and I don't think I have the right words. What is whooping soccer? What do you do?
Yep. So Whoopin' Soccer is a community arts outreach program that's based here in Madison, Wisconsin. We are an artist-in-residence program, so we bring professional teaching artists into third and fourth grade classrooms, and we work with an entire grade of students on creative expression through writing and improvisation and performance. We each week brings a different theme for creative expression, from writing and telling stories from pictures to telling true stories, to learning a little about playwriting and the tools of playwriting as a form of expression, to writing arguments that allow young people to make change in their world. We give them opportunities to write, to write together, to write alone, to dictate, to perform each other's stories. And then at the conclusion of the residency, our group of teaching artists, many of whom are also professional performers in the Madison community, create an entirely original vaudeville-style sketch comedy show of the kids' work. And we bring the kids to the Madison Youth Arts Center, and they all have an opportunity to see their work performed on a professional stage by professional artists as a mechanism of validating their ideas as not only creative, but valuable for the community at large.
And in just our last few moments, Erica, it's a new school year. Leave us with a bit of encouragement.
Oh, it's a new school year. I think all of us are entering it with a bit of trepidation. I like to lead with joy. I like to lead with the idea that coming together in community to make new ideas is an act of joy. And arts practices are the best way I know to infuse joy into our learning systems. So I would say, let's start the year with joy by valuing the artistic ways of knowing and doing that kids naturally bring to learning. And let's lift those mechanisms of expression up as valid, as valued, and as a way to bring all kids productively into our learning environments.
Erica, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Erica Halverson, professor at the UW-Madison School of Education and mayor of Whoopin' Soccer, a youth arts program we were just talking about based in Madison. Erica is the author of the book, How the Arts Can Save Education, Transforming Teaching, Learning, and Instruction. She just launched a podcast. It's called Arts Educators Save the World. And you could still share your stories of creativity in teaching and learning, maybe an art class or a creative teacher who inspired you at some point along the way. You can let us know about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Now, it can feel like we have more access to political leaders today than we've ever had in the past. If you hop online, you can reply to a tweet from the President of the United States or hear from them directly on Facebook or YouTube or you name it. But is online engagement the same thing as civic engagement? Our next guest took a closer look at that question and how the digital world has reshaped American politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you engage with politicians online? Do you do politics one way or another on social media? Do you follow elected officials or candidates? Or would you like to hear less of them when you turn on your phone or your computer? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Elizabeth Losch is a professor of English and American Studies at William and Mary. She's the author of several books, including her latest. It's called Selfie Democracy, The New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here.
One of the things that really struck me about the book is how much things have changed. You started in about 2008, and the Obama campaign is this innovative thing where they send a personal text or email to somebody, and people are excited. Like, wow, they're reaching out to me directly. Now, here we are just 14 years later, and we're like, enough with all the personal text from politicians. Can you talk about, first of all, just what a moving target this is in the political world?
Yeah, it's certainly during the start of the Obama administration, there was a lot of optimism about how technology could bring us more direct digital democracy. And there were these promises that you could be connected to the president, that you could participate in crafting legislation and policy, that you would have all kinds of new forms of access, and that data would be more transparent than it ever has been before. They promised to kind of get rid of all these intermediaries standing between you and your political leaders. And that optimism really turned around in the last decade. I think partly because the overreach of big tech companies running search and social media brands obviously are compromising our privacy and probably our free speech as well, and certainly our decision-making capacities. So I think that this kind of Obama optimism about technology really had took a darker turn. And I think Trump really took advantage of that. Although in the book, I argue that Obama and Trump actually have a lot in common.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Obviously very different in many ways, but that idea that you were just talking about of, hey, I'm a politician and I have this way to reach out directly to voters and the media doesn't get to interpret it or put context around it or critique it. That's going to be very tempting, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can bypass journalists, you can bypass elected representatives, you can bypass all kinds of gatekeepers who otherwise control your message. So it's very appealing. I think the other very appealing aspect is you can really slice and dice the data and you can make very specific targeted appeals to people, often drawing on their own user-generated content for social media.
What does that mean for us, though, as voters, if we have this, you know, direct outreach from a President Obama or a President Trump? Is it a net gain for us?
I argue that in a lot of ways, it undermines our trust in other forms of representative government, and that we have a tendency to invest too much authority in the leader of the executive branch. And we're not fully developing our civic identities because we're kind of relying on this sort of big celebrity persona that we're relating to through showing our own proximity or kind of feelings of connection to that person.
We're talking to Elizabeth Losch about her new book. It's called Selfie Democracy, The New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Prescott is with us in Lake Geneva. Prescott, hi.
Hey, you know what? I just wanted to bring up another point about the celebrity politics. And that's kind of what the games turn into, to where they can create these clickbait, you know, Twitter posts that really engage their followers and they get reposts. And I think it's poor for politics and politicians because now it's just become a chanting game so much and just to rile up the whole nation and you're losing touch with people in your representative community.
Prescott, thanks for the call. Elizabeth Prescott brings up, I think the quality of the communication we get from politicians who might be, you know, trying to get clicks like an influencer, not trying to serve us as an elected representative.
Yeah, Prescott makes a great point about the relationship between kind of clickbait and some of these forms of digital communication. It was funny to be researching the book and notice how much the style of presidential Twitter changed from the beginning with Obama to the end with Trump, because Obama often wouldn't actually kind of give us a soundbite that could move through the news cycle on Twitter. So there would be a link to a policy document that would be shared on Twitter. While Trump really had these sort of punchy headlines in his tweets that circulated through the media ecosystem much more rapidly. He was kind of a genius at live tweeting different kinds of public and political events.
Thanks for that call, Prescott, at 800-642-1234. Part of the story you tell is about how the media did, the reporting type media did and didn't keep up with what happened on social media. And that question is like, is a presidential tweet, you know, newsworthy? Does it deserve an article? Can you talk about efforts of the traditional media to understand this new political social media landscape?
Yeah, I think the traditional media still struggles to adequately cover what's going on in social media. I think just things like the ways the media covers TikTok, which I write about toward the end of the book when I'm writing about the Biden-Kamala Harris campaign, certainly shows its inadequacies. But, you know, one of the interesting things about the ways that the media covered social media from the presidential candidates is that they often wanted to project a particular kind of presidential authority. So, for example, Donald Trump used emojis hundreds of times in his tweets, and yet you would never, ever see those tweets on the network news. It was always something that was much more in keeping with the network news cycle that would get reposted. So in the book, I do a kind of deep dive on the kinds of tweets, you know, Trump composed over 50,000 tweets, right? There are a lot of tweets there. And I try to kind of look at the kinds of tweets that don't get media coverage. And yet those tweets might be very important to his followers. It's a way to build that community around the Trump message.
You also talk about that idea of digital communities, or at least what feel like communities that can form around a candidate, a political identity, or even conspiracy theories. And again, this is something that's really changing in the period you're covering, still changing now. Talk about what you see in these communities.
Yeah, I mean, and that's another thing that Trump does did with Twitter very successfully, is sort of hinting at a potential conspiracy without actually sort of stating its premises or any, you know, supporting evidence about it. And I think that's, you know, one of the features of these conspiracy theories is they often, you know, use partial information as a way to get people emotionally invested in a particular kind of story. But it's funny that, you know, Barack Obama began his political career by creating a personalized social media platform, mybarackobama.com. And now we see Trump with his own social media platform, Truth Social, which, of course, you know, has had some challenges in the marketplace because it doesn't moderate the content that might be tied to some of those conspiracy theories.
We're talking to Elizabeth Losch, professor of English and American Studies at William and Mary, with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Selfie Democracy, The New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you seen the internet and social media changing our politics? Do you converse with people online about politics? Do you argue with people online about politics? Have you seen a positive outcome, a way that social media helped you connect and maybe make a difference in the world? Or do you see nothing but negative? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Elizabeth Losch about her new book, Selfie Democracy, The New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do politics online? Do you converse? Do you argue on social media? Have you had to block people on social media because of political discussions spiraling downhill? Are you, in this midterm election season, overwhelmed by all the ads, all the emails from candidates and campaigns and outside groups? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Elizabeth, one of the things you talk about in your solutions chapter toward the end of your book is changing our culture of what we mean by civic participation in the digital media age. What kind of ideas do you hope start to take hold?
Well, I've also studied activists. My last book was actually about hashtags and the ways that people can get their messages out using social media by using hashtags more effectively. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from looking at the world of activism and the ways that people try to manage their own visibility and get a little more control over some of these tech companies. I do think that even though we're a very polarized nation, I think that both Democrats and Republicans agree that something has to be done about the power of these companies. We're talking about how Google and Facebook and Amazon and Apple really do have an outsized influence on our democratic processes. And I think finding that common ground can be difficult because people on the left are much more worried about misinformation, while people on the right are much more worried about censorship. But I think we still can find some common ground when it comes to not only regulating these companies, but also educating ourselves more effectively.
Well, let's take each of those points in turn. First of all, where do you see potential common ground for regulations? And we would need common ground, I think, in Congress to make it happen, for regulations on some of these big social media and search companies.
Well, even though the convenience of customization is something that many Americans have become used to, I think most Americans are getting pretty concerned about their privacy. And so I think that we can actually look to what's happening in other countries, particularly countries in the European Union, as a way to think about ways that we could get more control over how our data is used, and particularly how it's sold to third parties.
And then you said, kind of on a more personal level, this isn't something you can do with the law. What kind of thing do you hope that people who use social media are thinking about, are filtering when they're looking at the online political world?
Well, I think that we can all benefit from thinking critically about our own media literacy. I mean, I'm a fake news researcher, and I've fallen for fake news stories. And I think having a certain amount of humility when it comes to our ability to vet sources, I think is something really important. I mean, one of the things I say in the chapter on fake news is essentially throughout human history, there have been crises about fake news, particularly when we have new technologies. So when the radio came in, there was a lot of concern about fake news after Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast. So, you know, we might be just going through another one of those times in which we need to, as a culture, as a society, think about new forms of media literacy.
Talking to Elizabeth Losch about her new book, Selfie Democracy, The New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Elizabeth, as I mentioned earlier, we are in a political campaign season now. The topic of your book keeps on going even after the book is published. What are you seeing this year, 2022, from Republicans and Democrats that evolves the things you talked about in your book?
Well, I think one of the interesting trends is this concern about voting and concern about having ballots being properly counted when we have these digital voting machines. And I think this distrust in technology, which, you know, we certainly saw toward the end of the Trump administration, is something that I think is going to continue to be a factor in these midterms. You know, so far, we're not seeing as many kind of close elections in the primary season, although some of them have been pretty close. But I suspect that when we'll be getting into the general, we're going to be seeing a lot more concerns about, can we really trust technology? And I think more concerns about the ways that social media companies might be amplifying some messages and suppressing others.
I think there was a time where we could say, oh, who cares what's happening in social media? That's just out there in the ether. The last word of your subtitle, insurrection, points in another direction. When did we start seeing sort of online communities, political communities forming themselves and showing up in person again?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to see how the insurrectionists actually were shooting selfies in the Capitol, and they were sort of seeking that direct participation. You could argue that, you know, during the Tea Party movement, we also saw a lot of this sort of showing up in person, showing up at town hall meetings, showing up at school board meetings, this sort of need to kind of physically be present. But often that physical presence is in response to a digital call to action. So people get a social media post that encourages them to show up at a particular place, and then they shoot images for social media, or they film the event. And so there's this sort of cycle where social media tells us to be present and show up at a particular time and place and in a face-to-face, in-person interaction. And then we document our presence there. We make ourselves visible, and that goes back to the social media ecosystem. And I don't know if we can really disentangle ourselves from social media completely. I'm not one of these people who says, you know, we all need to essentially throw our smartphones in the garbage can. But what I would like to see is more transformation from that in-person interaction as well. And for those in-person interactions not to be so homogenous, for us to be able to, you know, have more diverse coalitions where we're coming together over common causes.
I think, and you touch on this in the book, there's this ideal that, you know, once upon a time, we all had this civic participation. We came together as communities to vote, or at least to voice our grievances in civil ways. I don't know, is this a mythical golden age, or is there something in the past you would hope we could come back to?
Well, I mean, one of the sections of the book, which talks about Obama's digital town halls, does point out, drawing on the scholarship of others, that town halls have sort of never been this kind of idealized performance of civics. But I do think that there are ways that we can do a little bit better. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of cases in the book where well-meaning digital initiatives got taken over by trolls or conspiracy theorists or other people. But I do think that the power of petitioning and the power of in-person protest really can be transformative. I think if you look back on the history of American politics, you'll see that people have managed to effect major changes by virtue of making themselves visible in different kinds of public spaces.
Let's bring on a caller. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Oh, hi, yes. Well, a statement and a question is why the FCC has more regulation on CB radios than any internet regulation. I just bought a CB radio last year for fun, for driving around Madison and on the highways around Madison, and it's been kind of fun, you know, to note an accident or something, and it just seems like we're just all bent out of shape on the internet. No civility.
Steve, 10-4. Thanks for the call. Steve pointing toward the internet maybe being under-regulated. Elizabeth, what do you think?
That's definitely true. I think that because this is a newer technology, there's been a tendency to sort of give it a pass and hope that it contributes enough to our information economy that we'll sort of let it develop without regulation. But as Steve points out, older technologies are much more regulated. Now, the other problem is sort of the too little too late problem with regulation. The Obama administration did have close relationships with Google, close relationships with Facebook, and, you know, really often sort of had a more optimistic and utopian view of technology that made it reluctant to regulate those technologies. And the other thing is the role of lobbyists, because far too often when we're looking at the FCC, what we're seeing is people moving from being lobbyists for cable internet providers, for social media companies. They're coming into the FCC, and then they're going back out into the world of lobbying. And this has happened with both Republican and Democratic administrations.
Steve, thanks for that call. And Elizabeth, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Elizabeth Losh, professor of English and American Studies at William & Mary, with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Selfie Democracy: The New Digital Politics of Disruption and Insurrection.